I'm Max Goller.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Pat, we've been looking forward to speaking with Reverend Matthew Best on the podcast for a while now. But this episode's unique because this time, the saintly sidekick we often feature is actually you.
Hey, Matthew.
Hey, how are you?
Good. You're also the first openly religious person we've had for our secular saint. You're actually kind of a religious saint, too.
Yeah, well, thanks.
I just want to explain real quick how I met Matthew. So I've been doing this homelessness awareness and advocacy and actually working in homeless shelter shtick for a long time. As a journalist, I've written and worked with on poverty issues for a long time. And I kept hearing about this guy. Matthew, you know who you remind me of? You remind me of Matthew Best. And it just kept, your name just kept coming up. And so finally, we reached out to each other because you were getting similar messages about this weirdo Pat LaMarche that's in the community. And we met for lunch. And we've been, I mean, I'm so excited because I'm with two of my absolute favorite fellas in the whole wide world at the same time. This is just such a great thing. But we got together and we started talking. It was good trouble, hopefully, pardon me, from day one.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been great.
So, Matthew, you are a politician turned religious figure.
Yeah, I got two marks against me. Yep.
I don't know that that's necessarily bad marks. I mean, they both have honorable people in them, you know.
I know. I like to jest about that, though, because of, you know, oftentimes politics ends up being used as a dirty word. And there's plenty of history of religion being used just like politics in those ways as well. And so I kid about that. And I also recognize that there's some truth to that. And then there's also some folks, like you just said, Max, who have really been very honorable and have made the most of both of those. I think they're more than professions, they're callings in a way. So, yeah.
Matthew, you have never told me what you did. Now, I know that you were staffer, congressperson, and I respect the fact that you don't want to share the congressperson's name.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Republican congressperson, though.
Yes, he was.
So tell us about that and how you ended up like pitching politics and going to seminary.
Yeah, so I think I got to start back further. Growing up, politics was my life. And I grew up in Western New York outside of Rochester, which is probably more in the suburbs of Rochester, which is more of a conservative area. And my family was kind of the traditional conservative, not like super ideological and all, but more like just kind of conservative politically back when that wasn't like insane.
So how far back does that go? Because I'm remembering my lifetime, it got pretty insane pretty quick.
Right. So I was born in 76. At least I didn't think it was insane at the time. Right. And, you know, I grew up in the 80s and at home. I graduated high school in 94. And when I went to a pretty conservative college, Grove City, which is in Western Pennsylvania. It's one of the schools that had a Supreme Court case about financial aid and did not want the federal government telling it what to do and all this. This is my background.
Can I just ask you a question about that? What did they didn't want to have to take financial aid, or
they didn't want the strings attached with the financial aid. They didn't want to have to do, I don't know exactly, but I know that there were some things that, you know, when you receive federal funds, you need to do certain things, and they didn't want that.
Yeah. You can't eliminate a gender. You can't discriminate.
Whatever the case may be. Right. And so I'm grateful for having gone there because, number one, that's where I met my wife. You know, there's the whole story that goes on with that, but it also, you know, it was interesting because I was actually in the minority being there is a pretty religious campus. And I was Roman Catholic growing up. And it was a pretty Protestant campus. And these are not, this is not that, this may not sound like, this may be really kind of unfamiliar territory, but there have been, at least in the past, very significant differences between Protestants and Catholics. And especially when you get into fundamentalists.
And that's my background, by the way. So you're not telling me anything. Yeah, I don't know.
Right. So there were people who had never met a Catholic before in their life. And I'm like, how is this even possible? There's a billion of us in the world. Like, how did you avoid that? Like, that doesn't make any sense. And then you hear like these crazy arguments. And I was like, what world did I step into? And felt like I was in the minority, which was a really good experience to not feel the privilege and the majority and all that type of stuff. So then I when I graduated, I worked for a member of Congress. I don't mind saying his name. It's Phil English. He represented Western Pennsylvania from Erie down to Butler. He was a pretty moderate Republican. He really focused on labor issues. And he was very labor friendly. Really not into the culture wars at all. That was not his concern. He was on Ways and Means. He was a money guy, a labor guy, pretty traditional moderate Republican. And again, great learning experience, and also really tough. Just from the standpoint that while I was there, this was the Clinton impeachment was going on. Talk about an experience. So he was one of eight Republicans who voted for only one article of impeachment. There were four articles of impeachment. He voted for one, and only because he couldn't be the only Republican who was going to vote for none. And because he's on Ways and Means. And this is, you know, this had to do, he was trying to make a political decision.
These are the ways and means that Congress works.
Yes, right. Ways and Means has to do with taxes. It's a pretty powerful committee. And so he was looking at what's the best interest for his district. What's the, you know, all these type of things. And so I just remember hearing him kind of like really struggling with this. It's not something that he wanted to deal with at all. He didn't think like, why are we doing this? This doesn't make a whole lot of sense. He didn't want to go through the whole process, all that type of stuff. He had more important things like, hey, there's labor issues. There's stuff going on in the district that matter to people every day. That's what he cared about. So, but going through an impeachment is also extremely stressful, and there's really no winners. It was quite an experience. I then went to worked for a lobbyist on the Hill, which was a great experience. It paid more for one thing, but it was a wonderful experience. And then when I got married in 2000, we moved to Carlisle. I did some of my own government affairs work, tracking legislation and writing and all that type of stuff. And then also working on campaigns. And I had been very active in the Republican Party at that point in Pennsylvania. This was 2000. You know, even I ended up becoming the chair of the Pennsylvania Young Republicans. By 2006, I had had enough. And what did it was it was the 2006 election. I remember this. This is like the straw that breaks the camel's back type of thing, right? After the 2006 election, I remember that the Pennsylvania House, this shows you what kind of a political nerd I am. Pennsylvania House of Representatives voted to put John Prezel in back as the Speaker of the House. And they all knew he was corrupt. And yet they went forward and voted for a corrupt politician to be the Speaker of the House. And I said, I'm done. I'm absolutely
done. Well, there's some foreshadowing there, right? On the next level of,
right.
They know he's corrupt. There's 34 felonies. We'll just keep him.
So, and that's not hyperbole. He ended up serving time in jail, along with several other members and leadership. And it was both Republicans and Democrats that had served time in jail, because there's a lot of corruption in Pennsylvania politics. And so I had enough. And so I ended up changing my registration to nonpartisan. And with one small exception, I have been registered nonpartisan since 2006. And that was in 2016. I re-registered as a Republican so I could vote in the primary. What good that did. And then I immediately changed back, not because I felt dirty. Anyway, having said that, there are some wonderful people who are Republicans, and you know, I feel kind of awful. I know some folks, but what switched was, I after that, I had a really love-hate relationship with politics. I was really hating it in a lot of ways, and was struggling with that. And I figure out, what am I going to do with my life? I ended up doing some campaigns. It was for more on the local level with some folks, and both Republicans and Democrats. And it was really about who was a really good person, who was a really good candidate, who was somebody who was going to stand for people, and what really mattered for people. And I wanted to help them get elected. And, you know, at the local level, it's not really the ideological things that are going on. It's more about how's it impacting people's lives. And I was doing some kind of, I ended up doing like a bunch of odd jobs. I had done entrepreneurial coaching for a while. And I got to the point where this just wasn't it. Something was missing. And this is where, you know, for me as a more of a spiritual person, I have the spiritual experience that I feel called into ministry. And I end up changing from Catholic to Lutheran as a part of this. And that's a big deal to go from Catholic to anything.
That's a very big deal to make any change like that.
Right. So here I am again. I've gone from being Mr. Politics and leaving that, and being kind of disappointed and frustrated and angry and all this stuff. That part of my life just gone. And here I am now religiously, another change going on. I feel like a lot of my life has been this kind of deconstruction of what I had originally, has just been kind of either pulled away or broken down or whatever. And so so then I start to follow this. The crazy story about this. So I have this spiritual experience, which I won't go into detail on, but I tell my wife, and she's a saint as well, for putting up with me, you know, I'm feeling called into ministry. And this, remember, I was still Catholic at this point. She's Lutheran. Oh, okay, great. What do you feel? And I said, as a Lutheran pastor, and she about dropped her mouth that I would do this. And I was working this job that wasn't paying much or anything. And I was going to be able to get a 2-week severance. And then I don't know what was going to happen. And I said, I don't know what this is, but I got to follow it. And she said, okay. And so it's a leap of faith. And so we kind of, so I don't know how we paid the bills, but somehow we paid the bills. And this was 2009. And then in 2012 is when I started seminary. And before that, I had worked for Project Share, which is the food pantry in Carlisle, as part of this kind of discernment and figuring out, what am I going to do when I grow up type.
Matthew, you know, you, to make a Kurt Vonnegut reference, which is, of course, where secular saint comes from, because mm-hmm. he said that's people behaving decently in an indecent time. But you remind me of Dan Wakefield, right? Dan Wakefield was one of Kurt Vonnegut's best friends. And Vonnegut used to identify himself as a Christ-loving atheist. His favorite part of the Bible was the Sermon on the Mount. He didn't know why people would put up the Ten Commandments when the Sermon on the Mount was such a better message. Yep. Oh, and by the way, from the Christian part of the Bible, and it's always Christians that are pushing for the Ten Commandments. You don't see a bunch of Jews saying we want Moses all over the place, right?
Right.
So his best friend, or one of his best friends, his longest friend, as Wakefield used to call himself, wrote a very famous article that appeared in the New York Times in 1985 entitled Returning to the Church, where he announced that he was going to re-embrace Christianity and return to the church, to which Kurt Vonnegut sent him a card in the mail and a drawing. And when Dan opened it, it said, "I forgive you."
It was a wonderful ribbing that they had. And Dan did equally get back at Kurt because he read in a magazine somewhere a poem that Kurt had written. And Dan sent him a note and said, "I see you're a poet now. I forgive you."
That's funny.
So you had this epiphany that you belonged in the church and doing churchy things.
Yeah.
Which could have been standing at the front of a wealthy church wearing fancy clothes and long dresses and stuff, and being the one kind of a guy wearing a dress that evangelicals approve of.
It's longer dress, that's why.
but that's not why I met you. Hey, you got to meet this guy who likes to wear dresses that preaches in churches. I met you because there are people who have sore mouths and bad teeth. And there's a parking lot filled with families who are living in their cars. And instead of being home with your wonderful, absolutely fabulous, I can testify to it, wife and four beautiful, wonderful kids, you're out in the parking lot buying people showers and feeding them. And that's why people told me about you. So tell us a little, because, and you are absolutely our secular / non-secular saint, because you could be doing, you are a white guy. You come from a world of comfort, right? You're born with, you're born with a pass on your face that says I can go anywhere because you're a white guy. And yet every single day you are with people who have sore mouths from bad teeth, are at the clinic to get healthcare. So why is that the kind of ministry you've chosen?
I would say it's not what I've chosen. It's what I'm called into. That's a very religious answer, but I think it's also—
We forgive you.
Thanks. I mean, this is a very special type of ministry. No doubt. It's very, very special type of ministry. And you got to want to be here, because there's a lot of frustrations. There's a lot of things that happen in the world that, especially right now, that have an impact on the people who are coming to the clinics. You know, like every day that I come here, I worry about a few weeks back, we had our Synod Assembly, which is where the church gathers in a large geographical area. And Pat, you had told me about this bill about criminalizing homelessness. And the day before that, I had heard, I got a message that ICE was active on 13th Street here in Harrisburg, which is what the church is located on. I mean, this affects the people that I see every day here. I think part of this also goes back to a little bit of my own history of just encountering, having personal encounters with death, and it humanizes you in many, many, many ways. When I was 14, I experienced a serious medical situation that put me in the hospital for 11 days and could have very easily killed me. But somehow I got through that and survived it. And, you know, at 14, having that type of situation teaches you about, you know, your own limitations, that you ain't going to be here forever. That's for sure. And so what are you doing with your time? What are you doing? And I think a lot of this has to do with how can we, you know, healing is has been a lot of my focus, I think, because of what I went through. Just a few years ago, probably the second worst thing that I've gone through is COVID. You know, I wasn't hospitalized for it, but this is what, 3 years? I think April was 2 or 3 years. I don't remember exactly. I think three years. Yeah, three years.
Yeah, three.
Is that your personal?
Yeah, my personal. The initial round of it took me 7 or 8 weeks to get over. And that was, I had run a half marathon the month beforehand. And when I got COVID, I could barely walk half a block from running 13.1 miles And a month later, I can barely, because I was so just wiped out and exhausted, right? And then went away for a month, got vacation, got better. And then I started having constant migraine that was just horrible. And so I've been dealing with migraines since. Now, actually, kind of, you know, because of medication and all sorts of other stuff, that they're actually manageable and whatnot. And so one of the things that I remember coming here, talking with my predecessor before I came here, he said, everyone who comes to Christ Lutheran Church is in need of healing. And that includes the pastor. And healing happens in a variety of different ways. This is not just a spiritual thing, right? This is physical. This is emotional. This is mental. This is social justice. This is community. This is all different ways. Everyone who comes here is in need of some kind of healing. And again, like, that's, you got to be really careful with that terminology, because there are churches that talk about spiritual healing and they don't mean it in the same way that I mean it. That's a manipulative way to get people to change this, that, and maybe their sexuality or whatever. I'm not talking about that at all. Healing has to do with wholeness. It has being in right relationship, whether that's with your body, with another person, with the rest of society, if you believe in God, with God, if it's with the rest of creation, whatever the case may be, that's wholeness. And that's what healing is. And it doesn't mean everything's going to be great. It doesn't mean everything is fixed. It's almost this kind of sense of peace of, okay, this is where I am, but I'm not alone. And that's a real big thing about being here, is it's not about, we're unique among free clinics. In the sense, because I talk with other executive directors of free clinics, and we're unique among free clinics in the sense that we don't do any type of intake form. You're like, we'll ask what somebody's name is, what do they want to be called? They could tell us their name, or they could make up a name. It doesn't matter. And then, why are they here? What do they need? That's it. We don't deal with insurance. There's no payment. There's no collecting of information. So we don't have to worry if authorities come, like, hand over your information. We don't have any. There's this level of trust in that anonymity. And I can't tell you how many times people have come to the door of the church and said, I heard that the church can help. I mean, that's a huge statement of trust, of what it is that we, why this church is here, why the clinics are here, and why healing is so very important.
One of the things I'd like to just stress is how absolutely ungodly unique that is. I used to be the operations manager at an overnight shelter where people would go at 9 o'clock at night and they'd have to be up at 6:30 and get out. And churches would lend us their auditorium floor that people could sleep on. And a 2-week-old might be sleeping next to a 70-year-old or a rapist. There was no way to know anything except that everybody needed a place to lay down. And we were at a church, and it was April, which is generally the Easter month, and it happened to be so this particular month. And the church, it was Holy Week, which is the week between Palm Sunday and Easter. See, I still know some stuff. And the minister contacted me and said, we are having a breakfast every day of Holy Week. And I thought he was going to say, would your people like to stay?
Yeah, right.
But he didn't. He said they need to get out 45 minutes earlier.
Oh my gosh.
And ooh. I couldn't say, are you out of your mind? Are you kidding me? That's just the most disgusting thing I ever heard, which were the words running through my head.
Yeah, sure.
But I needed the church floor. I couldn't chew this guy out for throwing out the poor.
So the people that Jesus hung out with.
Yeah. So the fact that, first of all, zero barrier like that is almost impossible, because everybody says, oh, our insurance company won't cover it unless you get their social security number. So that's one barrier they put up. Yeah. But this zero barrier existence that Matthew's talking about, where someone can show up at the door, say, I have a problem and my name is Bozo Klinkowitz. It's just like, you know, that's just unheard of.
Yeah, it's unique. I mean, like I said, it's unique even among free clinics. Oftentimes, and this is not a knock against the other free clinics. I mean, they're doing it because of their funding requirements oftentimes. Like, we don't take any federal or state money. And so we're free from having to collect. Now, we have lost, I'm not going to name the grant, but we had a grant that was giving us $20,000 for our dental clinic. And we had lost it. Why? Because we don't have enough data. And so we were not making a big enough impact, supposedly. I mean, never mind the 300 to 400 people who actually get service, and it was literally saving their lives. But because we didn't have the data to give to them so that they could look good in because of what they were giving to us, we lost $20,000, which is a huge chunk of money for we don't get any money for services. We live on donations and grants and foundations, and that's how we survive. That's why we're still open.
And it's not pray for tooth extraction. You know, it's not like the missions, which I can't say enough bad things about.
Yeah.
It's not pray for stay.
Right.
It's you're not a religious organization that says, oh, sure, we'll look at your mouth, but first you have to, you know, convert.
Nope.
This is no religious infiltration. It's just come, let us help you.
Yeah.
Let us, like you said, let us help you heal. And we have dentists, we have nurse practitioners, we have healthcare providers.
Right.
And we have access to the medicines you might need. And
yeah. And I'll say, you know, it's the people who work here, some of them are, they do it because they're religiously motivated, and other folks are not. And they do it because it's the right thing to do and they care about people. And I think that's the common thread, regardless of whether there's a religious motivation or not, is people are seeing the humanity of somebody and seeing that somebody has been either harmed or is in need of help. And this is what you do as a decent human being, is you try to help somebody. What your motivation is, there's a whole range, but this is what you do. That's the common thread in it.
So one of the things that I think has made us each other's BFFs around town, BFF for the homeless community, people experiencing homelessness, is that we're both such eager little puppies at the window, right? Matthew calls me and says, do you want to do something? And I'm like, sure, Matthew, what are we doing? And I do the same thing to Matthew, and he's always right there to do it.
Yeah.
We have got a bee in our bonnet right now about this SB 780 that has passed out of committee in the Pennsylvania Senate, which this is just so remarkable to me. The story is probably going to come out on Wednesday that I'm doing for work, and then I can make mischief afterward. But wearing my journalist hat, SB 780 allows people to rat out camps.
Oh, wow.
In fact, encourages it.
Oh, God.
So if you know where a camp is in your community, you can rat the camp out, and then the clock starts ticking. So as soon as the community is notified that there's a camp, say behind a grocery store or in the woods behind a park, as soon as someone says, gee, there's someone living there in a tent and they're gone half the day because they're at work, the clock starts ticking. And for every day the community doesn't destroy the camp, the municipality gets fined.
Good Lord.
And I would love to say that this is just some unique aberration in Pennsylvania. It's horrible that Pennsylvania is doing this. But since the grants passed decision in Oregon, this is hitting the entire country. And I'm here in Indiana. We're developing the same types of legislation. Everything related to the unhoused is, how do we get them out of sight? That's it. Not how can we help them? How do we get them out of sight?
Well, what's really stupid about this bill in Pennsylvania is they have literally given municipalities a reason to fight for the people experiencing homelessness, because they're fining municipalities. So, you know, the Pennsylvania Municipal Association, all these groups are against the bill, which is stunning, because they might have gotten some more conservative municipalities to go along with it. Some of the grants passes to go along with it. But they've built into it economic harm to the municipality that doesn't act quickly enough to destroy the camp. I mean, and I fear vigilantism, right? What happens if a person knows there's a camp back there and they're like, well, I'll just go destroy it myself because, you know, it's going to cost my town money. I mean, it's just, it's the fact that, so it's Matthew and my state senator who's one of the sponsors of this bill.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've done other things. We've slept out in the park. We've done all kinds of things. We've got the Memorial Blanket Project, and we'll, I don't know if there's a link to that up on the website already, but we'll put that. We're also going to put a link on the website, which is sacredlegions.org, if you're looking for the website. Matthew, for your clinic, so people who are hearing your story and the fact that you help people without question, if they want to help you, they can. So we're going to make sure we get that link up on the website. But one of the things you contacted me and did the shout out to me about was a book we wrote. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So the book is American Roulette. And the idea for this came, I was thinking about this the other day. It was January of 2023. This is June 2025. That's 2.5 years ago. It's pretty crazy. There was a mass shooting. Right. I don't remember which one I because there's it's ridiculous how many happen. Right. And a mass shooting is there's 4 victims. So we have a lot of these that go on 600 some on every year, unfortunately, which is insane. And I was just moved by it. I didn't have anybody personally involved. I wasn't personally attached to wherever this happened or anything like that, but I was just moved. And what moved me was the response. The response was, I finally saw, maybe it just kind of really hit me, of, you know, the typical response where what gets expressed is thoughts and prayers, which as a pastor, frankly, that's a statement of blasphemy because it's using God for an excuse to not do anything. And that drives me up a wall. And so that is blasphemy. Blasphemy is not swearing using God's name. It's using God's name for your own purpose. That's blasphemy. And so you get these politicians, oh, thoughts and prayers with no action, no intention to do anything about it. And so then what happens is you end up with this debate where people just talk past each other with facts and figures because everybody's got their own facts and figures. And then nothing happens. Really frustrating and just devoid of any hope that anything will ever be done. And so what I saw was like, where's the humanity in this? We have completely stripped the humanity out of gun violence. Now victims are just numbers, you know, like they're just numbers and it's just this, that, and the other thing. And so I remember sending an email on January 31st to Pat, and I had 4 different ideas of things. And this was one of them was, you know, let's write a book that highlights the humanity in gun violence. And let's just take one day and follow characters in one day in which at the end is the shooting. And we're not arguing for anything. We're not promoting anything. We're just focusing on the humanity of the people that we've been following and have been attached to, including the perpetrator, who is also human. And because it's really easy to scapegoat the perpetrators and then you get caught up in that, but they're human too. And things have happened that have brought them to this point. And you know, it's not just, oh, a nice little decision and all that. It's stuff is built up over time and society has got issues. And so you came back and you said, this is a great idea, but there's no way you can do this on your own. You've never published a book. And which is true.
I hope I wasn't that discouraging.
No, but it was true. And it was what I needed to hear. And I was like, okay, well then, and you said, well, what if we had a different author for each character? And I was like, oh, that's brilliant. And not realizing that, oh, this has never been done before. And I don't know what it takes to publish a book. And, you know, I was trusting you because why not? I trust you for other stuff. And so that's how this whole thing got started. And the beautiful thing is we drew together, you mostly brought in most of the folks, these 10 different authors, and egos were set aside because we don't profit off of this book either. And so how do you get 10 people to do anything as one is amazing. And to do this, I mean, it was a joy to write and to work out. And it continues to be a joy to be in relationship with all of these authors and the supporters and everybody else. And to see, you know, our main goal was we want to start to change the conversation around gun violence. And I think there's been some impact on that. If people are willing to get past the cover, right? Don't judge a book by the cover, and just actually read people that either are in supportive of gun rights or those that are in support of gun control, it changes the topic. It changes the conversation. It's no longer about this argument of facts and figures. It's now about the humanity. You know, what did you, I really identified with this character, and this was so sad, and you know, the psychology and all that type of stuff. And I think it really has that kind of an impact.
Max and I obviously pre-record these podcasts. So today, and the day that we're recording this one, Matthew and I in a couple of hours are going to be with the Pennsylvania State Library. And the Pennsylvania State Librarian has invited all of the state employees and actually the general public to come to this online conversation about American Roulette. And when I met the Pennsylvania State Librarian, which I'm pretty sure my nerd shingle is out there. No one's going to be surprised to find out that I live in the house of nerd. But when I met the Pennsylvania State Librarian, it was like meeting a rock star. You're the state librarian. I was just so thrilled, right? Uh-huh. And Max's wife is a librarian, so he understands. And she said to me, I wept. Mm. I don't weep at the end of books. She said, I cried through the end of this book because I loved these characters. Yep. And my head's got, you getting that weird tingly feeling, you know, when something is it was beyond wonderful to hear these words from this professional book person, right? There are millions of books in her orbit every day. And that was our goal. And even the Brady organization said to us, we've been looking for a piece of fiction for a long time because nobody wants to talk about the real people who die. I don't want to. Who wants to? Who wants to have my first recollection of reporting or dealing with gun violence was Columbine. Mm. I was a columnist. I was writing for a bunch of different newspapers. Ironically, I wrote a piece for the Lewiston Sun Journal in Lewiston, Maine about Columbine. And the day our book came out was the day of the mass shooting in Lewiston, Maine. It was just so trippy that 20 years later, that was the day. But I remember thinking about the school teacher who was dying, and the kids in his classroom were holding him. And it's choking me up 20 years later. He asked the kids to take his wallet out, take out the pictures of his children so he could look at them while he died, right? And this is the humanity you wanted us to talk about, Matthew.
Yep.
But I can't have that conversation about that man because right. It's just so tragic. And so we invented people. And I got to say, the more I think about our book, and it's amazing, it's 2.5 years, but the more I think about our book, the more I'm really impressed by Sherry Knowlton's Good Guy with a Gun that's in it.
Yeah.
Because the good guy with a gun is just such an important narrative in the United States of America. Yep. There are so many good guys with guns.
Yep.
You know, and so we can't talk about the book really any more than that without spoiling part of it. But it was a brilliant idea, Matthew.
Thank you.
And it was incredible. And your other ideas were good. It's just that one was so good.
Sure.
You know,
well, one thing that you can say about the book is to reiterate at this point that the title of the book is American Roulette.
Right.
It is for sale. And right. I read it. I encourage anybody that's interested in understanding gun violence and all that to read the book. It was a masterpiece that I still want to see in film, in comic book, in every form, because it was such a beautiful piece of work.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
And the thing about it too is, and we often will talk about this, is that every bit of the profit goes to organizations that address gun violence. So the authors receive nothing. In fact, it's cost us more than anything else, because this is a passion that we all threw ourselves into and something we care about.
Yeah, that is important. I keep forgetting to stress that. The publisher still makes money on the book, I'm sure, but the royalties, every single one of us agreed that all of our royalties would go directly to organizations to fight gun violence. And none of us were, and sadly, Charles Bruce Foundation manages the money. Sadly, you know, we haven't given away enough. You know, we've given away thousands, but we haven't given away the kind of money that we'd like to give away.
Right.
You know, and the big, beautiful bill has in it, buried inside of it, the legalization of bump stocks again. So, you know, the book doesn't deal with what would be a good answer, but maybe making a converter that turns your gun into a machine gun isn't one of those answers. So, you know, it's pushing a rock up a hill kind of thing, right? Just trying to deal with this. But I think as Cheryl Bychek said, who was our editor, sort of our holistic cat herder, because, you know, so many of us were writing the same book, it's a really good murder mystery. If you don't have any other reason to read the book, you don't know who the killer is. And the killer is written by a PhD who spent his parts of his life as a therapist in a prison, because we really wanted an authentic character to be the killer.
Yeah, the author didn't spend time in prison, like, as a inmate. Let's just specify that. But on the other end, on the other side of the prison. So
Yeah.
And that's not to say that's a bad thing. We've actually featured someone who was in prison in the past.
I mean,
and the message that Mr. Holbrook had was very important and very, very vital, and we're very glad to have him. I do want to try to segue into one of the things we really wanted to discuss in this episode in particular was the impact that funding changes are having on anything related to doing things for human beings. That whole idea of being a secular saint is the humanist part of that. What are we doing for each other?
Yeah.
And that's being impacted. So can you address that?
Yeah. You know, before I mentioned that we don't receive federal or state funding, but so we've been asked, you know, like, hey, has there been an impact on your funding? Not directly. So what happens is the people who have been receiving federal and state money, who have lost those resources, are now going after the same money that we've been going after through private foundations and grants and all that type of stuff. It's the same pool of money. It's just now there's some of that has been removed. And these other organizations, which do wonderful work, they got to be funded somehow. And so they're going to the same folks that we're going. And so that has an impact on us, right? So now we're all fighting for the same resources. And that makes it much more difficult, because now we got to get more creative. And, you know, we're already, you know, this is one of those things, like, this is an old building. It's been here since the congregation's been here since 1890. The sanctuary, the current sanctuary, is since 1920. And we're going to be doing a bell tower repair, not because we love the bell tower. You know, like, if I could just tear it down, that would be great. But it costs twice as much to tear it down than it does to repair it. And we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars. If I could go back in time and say, please don't build a bell tower, because 100 years from now, I'm going to have to deal with it and trying to find money for this type of thing, right? Nobody wants to fund repair to a bell tower. But if the bell tower collapses, the whole building is done. And so is the clinic. You know, the clinics are out of commission and all this type of stuff. So it's a vital part of what we're about here, is that bell tower's got to be secure. So I, you know, a lot of this, I think, has to do with what are our priorities. When we're talking about money, that's where it gets real. What are our priorities? Do we actually, you know, like, you've got a whole lot of folks who are, they claim to be Christians, who say that we're a Christian nation, which is bogus, first of all. You can go back to the Treaty of Tripoli that was signed by President John Adams, who, it says right in the treaty that the United States is not a Christian nation. Should be the end of the discussion. That's not what the founders had intention about. But if we're supposedly this Christian nation, then why are we not doing the things that Jesus talked about? What, you know, like you said, the Beatitudes. And we talked about in Matthew 25, one of my favorite passages, which is the judgment of the nations. You know, when was I hungry and you fed me? When was I thirsty and you gave me something to drink? When was I naked and you clothed me? When was I a stranger and you welcomed me? When was I sick and you visited me? When was I in prison and those are the things. And that's not just a Christian thing. That's just a human thing that you care. And that takes resources. You know, like this isn't just a nice, like you can go and do things. It takes resources to care. I know there are people who think, oh, the churches can do all this type of stuff. No, that's absolutely ridiculous. Number one, we don't have the resources. We don't have the people. Most churches don't have the training of how to deal with all these complexities. I had a colleague send me another bill, and I don't think this bill is going to go anywhere based on kind of my contacts and whatnot. But this was a bill that's going to allow, that would allow, and this has happened already in Texas, you know, because everything happens from Texas, apparently, which would allow chaplains, when I'm using that term very loosely, to replace school counselors. And it's only chaplains that are approved by a certain chaplaincy agency. And this has ties to white Christian nationalism.
There won't be any mom or
no,
rabbi.
No, of course not. Yeah. This is Christian nationalism chaplains who are there to proselytize their version and their brand of Christianity. It's a terrible bill. And in fact, professional chaplains who work in like hospitals and all, you know, and do important type of things have opposed this. That should tell you everything you need to know. Like if you've got chaplains who oppose a bill that would give more opportunities supposedly to chaplains, that should tell you that this is probably a bad idea. But you know, again, like there's funding that get so many things end up getting funded that we don't even think about that draw resources away from social services and all these other type of things.
So Matthew, you have a healthcare clinic and a dental clinic. Mm-hmm. And I just looked up, you're in Dauphin County, Pennsylvania, yeah, which is where the capital is. Mm-hmm. You have 78,232 people on Medicaid in Dauphin County. And if Medicaid is eliminated in the big, beautiful bill, you're going to have 78,232 people knocking on your door.
Yep.
I imagine that would be difficult.
Well, I will tell you since the beginning of the year that with the exception of this past month, so, you know, I have like full month data, right? So the data that we do collect is the number of visits of people who come. I can't tell you demographically anything about them except the fact that they look like the neighborhood. So it's diverse. So in January, the medical outreach clinic, which is the nurse run clinic, that had approximately 560 visits in January. And this is a clinic that's open 5 days a week. So 560-ish visits. And then in February, that increased to over 600. And then in March, it was close to 700. And then in April, it was over 700. And in May, it kind of leveled off a little bit. But I see no reason why that number is not going to increase because like there's just a need. And we don't have doctors. This is a nurse-run clinic. And so this is basic healthcare that we're providing with resources that you would get from a CVS or a Rite Aid or something like that. And people come to us because they literally have nowhere else to go. We are at the very bottom of the healthcare system. And I have said that, you know, like if the healthcare system worked the way that it should, then we wouldn't exist because we wouldn't need to. Because we'd be, as a society, we would be taking care of people the way that we're supposed to. So we're symptomatic that our healthcare system is not functioning. And now we're going to supposedly, if this bill passes, we're going to kick more people off of getting the help they need. It's kind of like what you were talking about before, Max, like, well, I guess we just want them to disappear and go away or die off somewhere. Let's just be honest. We want people to die off. Apparently in this country, we don't want to say that because that sounds rough, but that's exactly what we want. We want the poor to die off as a nation. That's what this bill is about. We want people that are inconvenient, and this is the rhetoric, that suck resources to die off.
I want to challenge a little bit of the rhetoric too, because we keep bringing up this term that they've chosen for this bill. And yeah. I would like to shift the rhetoric a little bit and say, to me, it's more like a huge, ugly atrocity as opposed to what they're trying to portray it as, because it's big. There's no doubt it's big.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's doing nothing beautiful for the country at all.
There's a wonderful theological and mythological term that I think actually applies to this, and it's Leviathan. And, you know, Leviathan, again, there's this kind of, it's this primordial, it's a concept of chaos. It's kind of this embodied chaos is really the simple version of it. And so what chaos does is it destroys, it's a version of evil in the sense of kind of more of like a natural evil, but it can also be kind of this intentional evil as well. And that's kind of what I think about this bill, is like it's Leviathan just in written form in a bill. And so, you know, if this passes, then we're going to unleash Leviathan on people, which is about chaos, which is about stripping things from people. It's about all the stuff that goes along with chaos.
You know, it's really remarkable too, that this is, people wanted the system changed. And unfortunately, in our binary way of voting, you don't get to change it in a nuanced fashion. You either vote for change or you vote for a certain amount of the status quo. And the status quo has been hurting an awful lot of people. We have the greatest wealth disparity in the United States that we've ever had. You know, you can play Bernie Sanders for the last 30 years and the speech hasn't changed, because it's all just the truth, except that the magnitude is getting larger. So when an awful lot of people were voting for a change to the system, I've been a major critic of things like FEMA, because FEMA goes into a disaster. And if a person was experiencing homelessness at the time of the disaster, they don't qualify for FEMA help because they were already homeless. So to me, FEMA needed to be corrected so that it embraced everyone impacted by the disaster, because you can't pretend someone isn't actually existing in Paradise, California, say, when the fire breaks out, right? They may have been living in the car, but they still got displaced.
Yep.
But what people got was, get rid of FEMA. What people got, you know, it's not possible to have a conversation that says, no, actually, they've tried in several states to have a work requirement for Medicaid. And in the case of Georgia, it was $69 million more expensive to provide Medicaid with a work requirement than it was just to give people Medicaid. Because needs assessment is a really expensive bureaucracy that is, you know, but you can't have these conversations because it is complicated. And my kid's soccer game's running and I can't even leave when the school nurse calls because I'm the only cook on today at the restaurant. And you know, so my kid's sick and I'm stuck here making somebody's cheeseburger, and people have such pretty kind of desperate lives, even though compared to the desperation in some other countries, you know, I mean, they wanted improvement, and what they've gotten is the promise of this Leviathan you're talking about.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we talk about other books. I thought it was nice in the last podcast we did, we talked about several books, and one that came to mind when you were talking about introducing chaos into government is Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, which is like a beautiful explanation of just how politics uses chaos for their own political gain. It's a beautiful piece of work, but it's chaos.
Really well-executed chaos takes a lot of planning.
Yeah.
And so anyone who thinks that we're just accidentally losing Medicaid or we're just accidentally shutting down FEMA doesn't understand the amount of plan, didn't read Project 2025 or whatever.
Yeah.
And doesn't understand that this is really well executed chaos.
I mean, this has been going on for decades.
Yes.
There's a documentary, I don't remember what it's called, but Paul Weyrich is kind of like the guy who got this going in the 70s. In the 70s, so it's 50 years ago, and he's the one, you know, He saw how you could mobilize the Christian right, because there's a variety of different things, right? So he comes from a more fundamentalist kind of outlook, which gets into this whole Christian nationalism and all this type of stuff, but also this mistrust of institutions and all this type of stuff. And this has been building, and he built all, like, he's the one who got Heritage Foundation going. He's the one who got all these other groups going to work on aspects of this. And it's been a 50-year project to get to this point of tearing things apart, which is really about changing the country and who the country is and what it's about.
It's called Bad Faith. Bad Faith. I just looked it up. Paul Weyrich. I'm gonna watch that.
It's a really good, and you'll be disturbed, but it's really good if you want to understand the history and really get a sense of who this guy is. I mean, the fascinating thing about this is this guy is not an inspirational speaker. He is not an inspirational speaker, yet somehow he got people on board to what his vision was in that.
Well, I think that's kind of fascinating too. I mean, for the life of me, the first column I ever wrote against Donald Trump was probably the late 1980s, early 1990s, when he was picking on Rosie O'Donnell, right? And I was just horrified that anybody would objectify a woman so publicly and so negatively, right? Just to insult her just so brazenly. But I don't see what people see in him. And so I think that there are probably people with this Lyric character who see an edge of him, or there's something he gives them license to be, which I think is
Well,
Trump's secret power.
the book I'm reading right now is called Outraged, and it's by Kurt Gray. And the subtitle is Why We Fight About Morality and Politics and How to Find Common Ground. It's really interesting. And Kurt Gray talks about this. So he actually has some criticism of Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind. And this has to do with understanding what motivates people in this. And so in this book, The Outraged, he essentially says that everything is based on, it's fear-based. And so when you have these messages, so morality is based on the trying to deal with the fears that you have of harm. It's the fear of harm. And so morality is not objective. Morality is based on what kind of harms that you're perceiving. And this goes back to ancient times, way back when we're just getting upright and all this type of stuff, and you're concerned about harm, humans are prey and all this type of stuff. And so now we're in the society where, for the last since the Enlightenment, we're very focused on facts, but that's not how our brains work. Evolutionary, it's still, our brains are still this fear of harm. And so what he's really arguing here, when I'm applying this to what we're talking about now, is what does Donald Trump offer? Is he's identifying some things, he's speaking to an audience of the harm that they're perceiving. And like a lot of folks, he's offering an answer, and it's a simple answer, and that appeals to people because of all the stuff that you were just talking about, Pat. Like, they're struggling to survive, and so they don't have the bandwidth to deal with the complexities of this. And here's a guy who's going to fix it, and he has a facade, at least, that he can make deals, that he can do stuff, he can get stuff done. Doesn't matter if it's true or not, it's perception is reality. And so this is what he is offering, is a reduction of harm to the people that he is talking to. And so and part of this too, like Kurt Gray is talking about, look, like, we got to humanize these folks who are on the opposing side, for the simple fact that how else are you going to actually build trust with them and then have a conversation and help people to see that, this isn't really helpful. Here's a different way. And we welcome you to get on board with that, which takes a whole lot of energy, and you got to set aside a whole lot of stuff, and there's anger. I don't want to do that, but gosh, that actually, like, has a path forward. And that's what I look at.
You are a saint. Oh my God. Matthew.
Well, and that's why we're happy to have you on, because we do want to represent this. And it is unique for me, the whole idea of this being secular. You clearly would not be representative of something secular, but it's the connection to other human beings. When at the beginning of this conversation, when you were talking about all of the steps that led you to get out of politics and get into the ministry and do what you're doing, it was always, how is it impacting other human beings?
Yep.
That is sainthood.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us, Matthew.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thanks for listening to Sacred Legions, hosted by Max Goler and Pat LaMarche. Original music by Jamie Calland. To hear archived episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. You will learn more about people behaving decently in indecent times and about the nonprofit organizations they support. Don't forget to check out our merchandise shop. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions, LLC.